Brendan Ford spent 50 years at sea as an officer on various merchant ships. He first went off in 1947 and has been all over the world several times. Born in Arklow, he spent his early years looking at ships and boats from the beach, and despite the best efforts of his parents to dissuade him, he made the sea his life. He retired in 1997 as commander of the Gráinne Whale, the Irish Light Ship. Now he's 88 and he lives in Dublin with his family. He has some remarkable tales of the sea to tell, and he recently came into studio to record some of his adventures. In this first story, he recounts witnessing an atomic explosion in the Pacific Ocean.
An atomic explosion observed. On 4th of June 1958, at Leith in Scotland, I joined the crew of the Irish Ash, owned by Irish Shipping Limited, and served as third officer under Captain Tom Byrne for a voyage to the USA. We had a cargo of fire clay which we discharged in Philadelphia and then went on to New Orleans. We sailed from there with a full cargo of soya beans for Yokohama, Japan. We entered the Pacific Ocean via the Panama Canal and set course towards Japan with the captain's intention to pass south of the Hawaii Islands. As third mate, I was normally appointed to the 8 to 12 hours watch routine. The chief officer covered the watch from 04 to 08 hours. A second mate did the watch from 12 to 16 hours, and also from midnight to 04 hours. We each had other routine duties also. The captain did not have any regular watch times. He was always available as required. The radio station was manned by a Marconi man, and all messages were in Morse code. I was a little surprised when I was informed that we had orders not to sail south of Hawaii, and was even more intrigued when I found Captain Byrne overseeing our new planned course. I was not informed of the origin of our change in course or the reason for the variation. The mystery thickened, though I somehow believed it to be of US naval origin. I cannot remember the precise date, but we were passing to the northeast of Hawaii and I was on duty on the bridge on the port side left of the ship, with a lookout and a helmsman in the wheelhouse. Our reliefs were due up at midnight and it was a very calm, clear night. At about 5 or 10 minutes to midnight, we were suddenly shocked by a prolonged brilliant flash of light to our south. It was not just a quick blink of light, it was quite prolonged, lighting up the ship even on the shadowy starboard side. Men who were asleep in cabins on that side told me they were awakened by the light. Almost immediately, we became aware of a thick reddish column of fire rising into the sky and recognised the characteristic shape of an atomic explosion. There was no sound or wind blast. Due to the Hawaii Islands being clearly outlined against the brilliant flash, I immediately thought of another attack on Pearl Harbor. I jumped into the wheelhouse, pulling in the lookout also, slammed the door and called the captain by blowing down the voice pipe to his cabin. "Captain, Bridge here."
"Yes, Bridge, what is it?"
"An atomic bomb just burst on the port side, sir."
"Thank you, Bridge. I'll be up in a moment."
A very cool, calm man at all times. I remember suddenly thinking of all the glass windows in the bridge that would be blown in and shattered when the wind blast arrived, and the damage it would do to us, but it never arrived. Nevertheless, we ordered water on deck and opened all fire hose connections to wash down the accommodation superstructure. The American government conducted 67 nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands between 1946 and 1958, including the well-known Bikini Atoll. What we witnessed was one of two American nuclear tests that took place at Johnston Atoll, nearer to Hawaii, on August the 1st and the August the 12th, 1958, about 17 degrees north of the equator, 169 degrees west of Greenwich. A 3.8 megaton explosion from a bomb launched on a rocket at Johnston Atoll. We witnessed the explosion on August 1st. None of the crew suffered medically as a result of the experience. Japanese fishermen, nearer to the explosion than us, developed skin burns when rain fell on them. Our biggest problem was social exclusion after we arrived in Yokohama. The local girls would have nothing to do with us when someone told them what we had seen. I may be the only Irish Merchant Navy officer to call down to his captain, "Captain, atomic bomb just burst on the port side," and live to tell the tale.
And we'll have more of Brendan Ford's adventures over the coming weeks. Yesterday and today, Bord Uisce Mhara have been hosting a conference of oyster producers in Carlingford, County Louth. The seafood sector is a huge industry for Ireland, and I took the opportunity to meet the BIM chief executive, Jim O'Toole. He first told me about the conference of oyster producers.
Fergal, we had a oyster workshop in Carlingford yesterday and today. We're very pleased that we had over 120 people attend, which is a very significant turnout. So we're delighted with that. It's a great opportunity for the industry, for us and for other agencies and the industry to reach out to one another, to share with them the latest developments, the latest issues. And also, I think what's really important is that the oyster industry gets to meet one another and to talk about their issues and share their experiences. And then this morning, there were some site visits that the local producers up in Carlingford put on for their fellow oyster producers around the country. So obviously people obviously like to see what is going on in other parts of the country and how things are going there.
How big is that business, is the oyster industry in Ireland?
Well, the oyster industry in Ireland produced 10,000 tonnes in 2018, which was something of a high point. It's been growing for the last number of years. And we had export value in 2018 was also a high point and was worth €43 million. So there are lots of oyster producers dotted around various bays, particularly in the south coast and the southeast, and also in Donegal, but in other bays around the country as well. So we reckon we had representation from about 85% of the business that are involved in the oyster sector at our workshop over the last 2 days.
It's a relatively big employer for an industry of its size?
It is. It varies in terms of scale, but it is relatively labour-intensive. So it is an important local employer for those areas. And I think what's we have found in a number of cases in the whole seafood sector is that the employment that is provided, it's in obviously remote parts of the country. Mm. So it's a very valuable driver for the local economy. And of course, you have all the ancillary industry that goes with it in terms of logistics and supply and all the things that go with the sector as well. So it's very important from that perspective.
I'll ask you an amateur question about how oysters are grown or produced. Mussels, I know, are produced on ropes which go down to the seabed and they grow on that. How do you produce an oyster?
Well, oysters are very efficient and natural shellfish, and they're grown primarily on trestles. So these are relatively low-sized trestles, steel frames, that the oysters, when they reach a certain maturity, are put in bags, and they're on the trestle, and then the tide obviously washes over them, and it's important that they have that balance between being out of the water and in the water. But it takes over 2 years to produce an oyster.
Do they need to be fed or anything?
Oysters are great creatures. They filter feed, so they feed from the plankton and the nutrients that are in the sea. So there's no added feed, if you like. They filter feed from the ocean.
Like mussels, though, they probably are very susceptible to pollution.
They are sensitive. We're lucky in Ireland that we have good water quality, but because the oysters are being grown and they're maturing, they are susceptible to disease the same as any other animal. And there are issues where if there's a breakdown in water quality or there are diseases, they can suffer like any living creature as far as that goes.
So I put my oyster on my trestle, I've grown it. what happens next when I go to pick it or harvest it?
Oysters, when they reach a certain size, they're harvested. They're obviously managed in that the bags are turned so they get an even distribution of growth. So it's quite labour intensive from that goes. When they reach an age of maturity, then they're brought ashore and they're graded and they're packed and then they're dispatched for export market. The biggest export market that Irish oysters go to is France. It takes the majority of our oysters. But in recent years, the Irish oyster has been exported very successfully to Asia. And there is now a premium being got for Irish oysters in Hong Kong and China.
How do you get them to Hong Kong? Because they're sold more or less alive. It must be a very complex operation.
The Irish oyster industry are incredibly innovative, and they have developed this market in the last 5 years. Many of the Irish oysters are air freighted from Dublin to Hong Kong and to Shanghai and Beijing. Unfortunately, at the present time, given the epidemic in China and the restrictions that has caused, that trade has temporarily been suspended, which is a concern for the sector.
Here in BIM, it's an organisation we've heard about all our lives. Can you tell me something about what you do here?
Our job is to try and help the seafood sector to develop. We work with the wild catch sector, we work with aquaculture, and we work with processing. We have a range of initiatives where we have, for example, two national fisheries colleges, one in Donegal and one in Castletown Bear, where
they have great reputations. I've met people who've graduated from there, who've come abroad to go and study there.
Yeah, they have BIM, I think, is probably synonymous with training. So everybody that is involved in the sector that's a skipper will have gone through a BIM college and have done their qualifications there. We do safety training. We do engineering courses. We have aquaculture courses. We have recently launched a course for commercial diving to help the aquaculture sector.
We actually had a report on the programme from it maybe a year ago.
Great, delighted that you chose that subject. We also work. We have a course on this week where we're training fishmongers, so helping to increase the skill at retail level, so that the retail offer is improved to attract consumers and to educate the retailers in that regard. So that's one side of the activity we do. We have an economics and strategic services unit here, where we do a lot of data collection and analysis in terms of the economic health of the sector and the things that are impacting on that. And in about a month's time, we will be launching at the Skipper Expo in Limerick this year our 2019 Business of Seafood report, which is an analysis of the whole sector. We have from our Galway office, we have a fisheries conservation team, and they are looking at gear technology, and they are working with the industry in terms of helping the industry comply with the landing obligation and developing new type of nets so that they do more selective catching, so that the targeted species is captured and the non-targeted species aren't, and that's very important from a sustainability point of view.
I was at the Skipper Expo last year and I met one of your people who was showing fishermen one of these nets. They're kind of an escape hatch at the very end for very small fish. Simple technology, but very effective.
Amazing work actually done to a very high scientific peer-reviewed level and very useful for the selective gear that fishermen use. Sustainability is at the core of what we do, and this is a very practical but real example of how we are working with the industry to help them produce more sustainably, so that we can conserve juvenile stocks and avoid catching juvenile and non-targeted species. It is some very advanced technology in what might on the face of it sound like something that's quite straightforward.
If I'm a small producer, say of oysters, or I want to be, or I own a small fishing boat somewhere, I'm looking for help. What kind of help is on offer from BIM?
We have a whole team of colleagues around the coast who work with the inshore fleet. We're working with them at the moment. In the last number of years, we developed an inshore strategy, and we're working on implementing that with regional inshore fisheries forums, which are there to identify what supports are most required in helping that sector organise itself, prepare itself, improve the skills that are there. But there's also a whole side of our work where we are in receipt of significant funding from the EU under the European Maritime Fisheries Fund, the EMFF, and we dispense grant aid to the whole sector under a variety of programmes, with 13 or 14 different programmes. For example, if there's a programme about sustainable fishing, so that we can grant aid fishermen to make improvements on their vessels so that they're fishing more sustainably. So that's just one example. There's investments for capital equipment in processing. There's quite a broad range. I think we're constantly in touch with the sector, trying to understand their needs and trying to help them to develop their businesses.
You mentioned fishmongers. If I go into my fish shop, fish is quite expensive. Why is that?
Well, from an industry point of view, we're always trying to ensure that the unit value is increased. So that's something that we like to see, of course, is that the return from the catch for the fisherman and for the processor makes a viable business. But of course, from the consumer point of view, if fish is too expensive, well, then there's going to be a limit. I suppose ultimately it's down to scarcity and also that there's a very high demand. Irish seafood is exported to the UK, to continental Europe, to Asia, to Africa. So there's increasing demand for seafood, and we are limited in terms of the amount of supply that it can be caught from wild caught. So it's about trying to find the best markets for the products that we have available. So I think when there is curtailment on supply and there's a strong demand, price is going to be at a level. But of course, it's important that it's not that we don't price ourselves out of the market.
You mentioned Brexit. It must be a worry for you, for the industry as a whole, because you're selling all the product into the UK.
Brexit is a significant issue for the seafood sector. There is significant negotiations that have to take place this year for a trade deal to be achieved. Fisheries is going to be front and centre of that negotiation. I think we're fortunate that the EU understands very clearly the importance of the seafood sector, particularly here in Ireland. So can't really comment on that any further, because it's a negotiation that is going to play out over the next number of months. But practically speaking, from a trade point of view, unlike other sectors of the food economy, the reliance on the UK is not as great for seafood in comparison. So that it takes about 12 to 14% of our exports. However, there is a lot of preparation to be done by the sector, and the sector are preparing very well for the changes that are going to take place in reaching the continental market. Shipping products through the UK, using the UK as it's known as a land bridge, is something that could be problematic, particularly when you're talking about seafood, where it's a high value, short shelf life product, and the demands of reaching various distribution centres in the north of France, for example. Those windows for delivery are very narrow. And delays are something that could have a serious impact. So we have been working, and all the agencies, the SFPA, the Food Safety Authority, all the other agencies are working with the sector to make sure that they're prepared, they understand about the documentation that they'll have to be on top of, and that the logistics that they have arranged are such that they will try and minimise those problems, and very importantly, that they are talking to their customers about the changes that are going to take place. So it is something that is a significant change. We don't know yet the final nature of what it's going to look like, but it's going to be different, and therefore there's a lot of preparation required.
Thanks to Jim O'Toole, Chief Executive of BIM. The River Boyne makes its stately way through the northeast of the country and is shrouded in mists and mythology. It's the most historically significant river in the country and has played a central role in events here from the Stone Age. A regular contributor, Hugh Oram, has been to visit.
The River Boyne may be one of the shorter rivers in Ireland, but it compensates for its shortness with an amazing variety of fascinating historical and other connections. It rises near Carbery in County Kildare and flows through County Offaly before reaching County Meath. By the time it's reached Drogheda, it's a substantial river, crossed by a bridge carrying the M1 motorway, then by the Boyne railway viaduct in Drogheda. It eventually reaches the Irish Sea between Mornington and County Meath and Baltray and County Louth. The length of the River Boyne is quite short, a mere 112 kilometres, yet many historical events have taken place beside it, most notably the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, one of the great turning points in Irish history. The river also passes through Trim in County Meath, goes past the Hill of Tara, the ancient capital of the High Kings of Ireland, the Hill of Slane, the megalithic monuments at Brú na Boinne, and the many ancient monuments in the Boyne Valley. It also passes through the heart of Drogheda itself, and for many centuries has helped shape the formation of that ancient town. The Boyne has been well known since ancient times. Nearly 2,000 years ago, the Greek geographer Ptolemy drew a map of Ireland and he included the River Boyne. In Irish mythology, it was believed that the river had been created by the goddess Boann, and Boyne is an anglicisation of her name. It was also in this river that Finn McCool captured Fionnton, the salmon of knowledge. And some years ago, the Boyne Fishermen's Rescue and Recovery Service found an ancient log boat in the riverbed near Drogheda. It was estimated to have been about 5,000 years old. It was far older and far more interesting than the present-day shopping trolleys that are often rescued from the Boyne. And about 15 years ago, the remains of a Viking boat were found in the river close to Drogheda. One of the other interesting features of the river is the Boyne Navigation, a series of canals that run parallel to the river from Oldbridge near Drogheda as far as Navan. The canals are mostly derelict, owned by Antashka, but they are being restored by the Inland Waterways Association of Ireland. The canal at Oldbridge, close to the Battle of the Boyne site, was the first to be restored. A recent creation on this river is Boyne Boats, founded by Ross Kenny. Among his earlier jobs was as water activities manager at Meathlmara, a community boatyard based at the Lock in Cork City. 5 years ago, he moved to County Meath, and he soon discovered, to his amazement, that the Boyne was totally unused. So he set up Boyne Boats, which uses traditional Irish boats to provide informative boat tours on the River Boyne and the Boyne Canal system. Mihil Mara specialises in building traditional Irish curraghs, especially the magnificent Kerry-style Nemhog and a version of the two-person hazelrod curragh used around Dunfanaghy on the north coast of County Donegal. It also provides repair services as well as building boats for all kinds of exhibitions, documentaries and films such as the Game of Thrones. Cathy Buchanan of Mehelmaha said that they made 2 4-hand Nemhogs for Boyne Boats over the past few years. These boats have the special addition of 8 canoe paddles apiece, as well as the usual sets of 4 pairs of oars and a steering oar. She adds that they build boats to commission and they'd be glad to supply further boats to Boyne Boats. So between the special boats used by Boyne Boats and all the attractions of the River Boyne itself, this North Leinster watercourse is indeed a very special place.
Hugh Oram. And a reminder that the National Angling Expo is on this weekend in Swords, County Dublin, opening tomorrow morning. It has exhibitors of all kinds, from boats to tour guides to tackle, and this year Inland Fisheries also has a stand to encourage women to get involved in angling. They'll have free trial days and courses on offer for any women wanting to get involved in the sport. The show is in the National Exhibition Centre near Dublin Airport.